It was kind of ironic for me. It was a great day because if you think about it, I brought up George earlier, who he started his career with, Dr. J. As you know, when I was drafted, and I really believe this is the reason I was drafted by the Philadelphia 76ers. And I think a lot of it had to do with the guy they call the doctor, Julius Erving. I knew Doc from the time I was 10. So he kind of knew what kind of person I was. I guess he saw me developing as a basketball player and he had heard some things about me during my college career. So I'm kind of going to shoot a shout out to the doctor for possibly being the reason I was even drafted by Philadelphia in the first place. Thank you, Julius Erving. I love you.
I love that. That's great to hear.
And you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off, and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
So we're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Strand, you made the pass. Yes. Christian, can you catch the ball? Yes.
All the stars were aligned, and all the muscles fired at the right time, and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 95. Thanks for joining me. Today, I'm very happy to welcome a Detroit native who starred at high school in his home state of Michigan, Derek Gervin. We discuss his cross-country move to play at a college where his jersey is one of just two to have ever been retired to the rafters, the University of Texas at San Antonio. Coincidentally, as Derek continued to hone his skills at college, his older brother, future Hall of Famer George the Iceman Gervin, was lighting up the NBA with the San Antonio Spurs. Leaving college after his junior year, Derek was drafted to the NBA before eventually traveling overseas to star in Europe. He would return to the States and realize his NBA dream. We cover this and much more in a wide-ranging conversation. Derek is a great storyteller and shares some fantastic memories from his life in basketball. Check out his own show, Derek Gervin's As Good As It Gets Basketball Podcast. He's had a stellar list of guests, including his brother, the Iceman. Search for it on your podcast app of choice. A slight correction, Derek played three seasons with UTSA, leaving after his junior year. I inadvertently refer to Derek's junior season as his senior. For context, this chat was recorded just prior to the madness that was 2019 NBA free agency. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, will be available at inallairness.com/95. Now, onto the show. My guest today, as a high schooler, was twice named to Detroit's All-Public School League first team. His name dominates the University of Texas at San Antonio's record books, where numerous achievements still rank him number one all time. He played two seasons in the NBA and has a wealth of basketball experience within the US and internationally. Derek Gervin, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome, Adam. Man, you do your research, my man.
I try my best, so I'm really looking forward to talking about your career and life in basketball. Given that your older brother, George, happens to be one of basketball's all-time greatest players, your formative years must have been incredibly unique. What can you tell us about your experiences growing up and learning the game of basketball?
Well, I've been around the game. I'm 56. I'm a young 56, but I've been around the game pretty much all my life. I had an older brother, Booker Gervin, that probably was the best player in the family.
Wow.
And he was about 6'2". But he was a basketball junkie. And I had a brother that passed away a few years ago, Claude, my second oldest brother. So I grew up around guys. The only game I knew coming up was basketball. And George was the second youngest of the boys. I'm 9 years the youngest, so I'm 9 years younger than George. So I saw these guys basically in their teen years. And what I picked up was the work ethic. These guys were very fundamental. Today the game, you're looking at a different game. We'll get to that a little later on. But it's a change. All I knew then was work ethic, work ethic, work ethic. And, following those guys kind of got me on the right path. So, I want to give my brothers a little shout out and thank them for the career that I did have.
That's fantastic to hear. If your brother Booker actually was the most talented, perhaps early on, what were the battles like in the backyard or at the playground when you guys would get together and try and play? How are they?
Well, it was funny for me because I was the young kid. They wouldn't even pick George. And George is like 14 or 15, man. It's unbelievable. My brothers would go to the park. In Detroit, we played outside a lot as well as in the gym. So they wouldn't pick George, man. He wasn't very good. At 14, I'd say he was like maybe 6'1 or 6'2. So by them not picking him, it kind of lit a fire under him. So, he would start going to the gym every day. And I do mean every day, except maybe Sunday. So every day that the gym was available, George was there. We watched him just keep developing. All of a sudden, man, he just all of a sudden had a growth spurt. And as he started to grow, you know, his stature, his height started to grow, so did his game. You could see that he had worked hard on things. It's hard to explain. You know, all of a sudden, he started using the left hand. He started using the, right hand. He started shooting underhanded, hook shots. His creativity, I'll never know where he picked it up. But I assume in his gym working by himself, he just started envisioning being all these different type players. And he put them all into his game. And, you know, to me, he's become the best offensive player that I've ever seen in my life as far as biggest arsenal of shots. So it came from just trusting himself and believing in himself and just putting in the work.
At what age did you start to blossom in terms of your basketball skills? You're around about 6'8".
I'm 6'8", yes.
Yeah, 6'8". So when did you start to grow into your body in terms of your basketball frame? And you had your junior and senior seasons. You were playing at Martin Luther King High School. Do you mind just talking a bit about that experience and what you can recall from those early days in high school?
I got the jump start on my other brothers, Adam. By the time I was 9 or 10, we had this league in Detroit called the PAL, P-A-L, Police Athletic League. And I played in that from the time I was maybe 9.
Okay.
My mom, every week that was like priority. Whatever that was on the agenda, when it came to Saturday, nothing was more important than my games. So I had got a jump start on those guys. I was a pretty good player. At 10 years old, man, I became kind of like the gunslinger, I guess, kind of like Kawhi this year.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How they bring in that player to get you over the hump. And that was kind of like the reputation I developed as a young guy playing on the AAU circuit. Some teams would bring me in just because they couldn't beat other teams. And I was that guy that they bring in, try to incorporate to the team and help them get over the hump. So that's something that started young in my career.
And that continued on for many years. So I read in the research for our chat today, when you were a junior at Martin Luther King, I'm talking about February of 1980 at the moment, there was a game where you dropped to 38 points and you hit a 38-footer with 2 seconds left to win the game for your Crusaders. It was a 2-point win over a team called Romulus, I believe. What do you recall from that game-winning shot and just that performance in general? Does that come to mind?
Yes, and I'm going to tell you why it comes to mind. A former teammate of mine with the Nets, Terry Mills, and I'm sure you're familiar with Terry.
Mm-hmm.
Terry is a few years younger than me. So when I was playing against Romulus, I believe they were the number one team in the state at the time. I was at Martin Luther King. I was a junior. Terry was at the game watching, and I think Terry at that time was like maybe 12 years old, 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And, man, we played on those funny backboards that are shaped. They're not the square backboards. The little small, funny shape. Yeah, those. Yes, sir, yes.
Yeah.
So we played on those, man, and at that game. It's like one of the best games of my career. I was pumped up for the game. They had a gentleman, an all-stater on their team, first team, by the name of Desi McClung. And this guy, Desi, was one of the best, the top 3 or 4 in the state. So it was my chance to prove, it was my coming out party, basically. And I took that game like it was an NBA game. In Detroit, in high school, you're treated like the pros.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I felt like it was like my coming out party. I rested for the game. I came out, had a pretty good game. And then I was just fortunate enough to hit a half-court shot to win the game. And Adam, I have to tell you, every day after when we had a game at Martin Luther King in my career, I always practiced my half-court shots before the game and after the game. So that was just something that had, a lot of practice. It paid off for me. Kind of like Steph today. You see Steph make some of these shots, and it's only because he practices them all the time.
Practice makes perfect, I guess. And if you have a chance to launch one of those shots and it can tie or win a game for you, then obviously it's going to be a great thing. So a 38-point effort, hitting a game winner with a couple of seconds left. Terry Mills would actually later play for Detroit, of course. I think I'm blanking on which college he went to. Was it Michigan?
Michigan, University of Michigan.
It was Michigan, yes. So obviously, he's got some big links to Michigan as well. Later that same month in 1980, you were named the Detroit Free Press's All Public School League first team. And it said that your averages were about 25 points and somewhere between 12 to 15 rebounds a game. And then you made it to the semifinals of those 1980 playoffs. What in general do you remember about playing basketball at that time in your junior season?
I learned about preparation. We actually had the best team in my, I believe, in the city, my junior year and my senior year, but didn't handle it well. And I'll be honest about it because I tell the kids today, if you don't do the right things, you're going to get bad results. We stayed out. I partied a lot during my junior year. And, you know, I thought I was in the pros already. In my mind, mentally, I was already in that next league. So I didn't rest properly for the games. And we come out, we get beat. We're one of the best teams in the city. We were actually ranked number one going into the Detroit high school playoffs my junior year. But I didn't do the right thing. So I come out, I stink it up. I scored 10 points and we go down. It's funny because the next year I pretty much the same thing, Adam. Not preparing myself again and we go down again. So, you know, it just taught me about being more like George. George had a good work ethic, a great work ethic. And I learned to just stop cutting corners and start doing the things that it was necessary to be successful.
Yeah, well, your talent obviously was still holding you in good stead. I read that a January 1981 article, it highlighted a mid-month win that your team had where you had 30 points, 24 rebounds, and 8 blocks. And there was a quote in that article which says, Derek Gervin put on another of his dazzling shows. Now, it said you were 6'7" at the time and you were playing center for King. What position did you sort of favor the most?
Adam, I have to tell you this. Now, when I was in high school, I had an exceptional team. It's very rare that you have guys that you could go from like 1 to 10. I had like 10 guys that we could play, and the coach could have a lot of faith in them. So I didn't have a normal team. So I kind of played out of position. They had me playing center because I was the tallest guy. But I felt like then I was a two guard in a center's body. So I always worked on my ball handling. You know, George always worked on his ball handling. That was always something we wanted to do because I didn't want to have to depend on players to have to get me the ball. You know, occasionally you have to show players that you're capable of getting the rebound. You tell the guard he can go on down the floor and start running, and you can create the break yourself. It's kind of like Draymond today. Draymond Green, you know, he can initiate the fast break. Kawhi, as you saw, could initiate the fast break. And that was something that I tried to do back then. I always thought that the more things you can do, the more valuable you are. So I just tried to work on as many facets of the game as I could.
Yeah, well, it seems you're a very versatile player for sure. Now, in late February of 1981, you were again named the Detroit Free Press's All Public School First Team member. And according to that newspaper, you averaged around 24 points, 15 rebounds, and 5 blocks as a senior. Do you recall how far that your team advanced into the 1981 playoffs?
We were rated number 5 in the state. We went to the state championship that year. We ended up losing in the quarterfinals. We played the number 1 team in the state, Highland Park. So it was number 1 against number 5. I still to this day, and I'll believe it to the day I die, we were the better team. We end up, and it's kind of sad. I'm glad I grew up a little bit. We end up losing to Highland Park on a very questionable call at the end of the game. If they make the right call, we win the game. But they end up calling a charge on us. So we lose the game 84-82. After the game, we had a big old riot. And I mean, we fought on, oh man, chairs were thrown, the entire works.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, that was my last game of my high school career. And we had, you know, our fans supported us. They traveled with us. And we took it serious. I told you how it was like the NBA. And we really felt that way, and they still treat the players like that today in Detroit. So it just got out of hand, but it was a learning experience for me. It taught me that the game is bigger than, you know, the behavior is always part of it. So you have to conduct yourself, whether you're on the winning end or the losing end. So that, you know, something good came out of it, even though he had a bad turnout to fight, but something good did come out of it.
I'm really interested in your thoughts on what unfolded next. Now, please correct me if I'm wrong with my timeline here. But you left high school and sat out a year. and moved to San Antonio with your brother, George. You regrouped, got your high school diploma, and you were set to play for Coach Abe Lemons, I believe, at Texas San Antonio, but he was fired. What was that transition like as you left high school and started to adjust to get ready to play it in college?
It was different for me because I had to readjust. When I was in high school, I'm actually the one in my family that qualified to go to any school in the country. And I went to the best high school in Detroit. I look back on it now. If I could do it differently, I might. I transferred from Cass Tech, and it took like a 3-point-something grade point average to get in there. So I go to Cass Tech. I stop competing academically. I got lazy. So I leave there, and I start struggling. I transfer to Martin Luther King. I go there, play my 2 years. But before my career is over, I get a message that we're leaving and moving to Texas. And man, I took that negative because I liked where I was at. I loved my hometown. I loved all my friends. I didn't really want to go to San Antonio. So I started skipping class. And I ain't going to lie about it, Adam. I missed 55 days of class my senior year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I had some catching up to do. I moved to San Antonio to kind of bring me back down to earth. I needed to be grounded and, you know, took away all the different temptations of Detroit. So when I got to San Antonio, I needed a year off to prepare myself, get myself ready mentally, and to deal with my family uprooting and, you know, leaving all my friends. I come down here, I started taking things a lot more serious. What am I going to do with my future? I knew that God had given me a gift. My best gift was basketball, and that was something I didn't want to pass up. So I started taking things a lot more serious. I crushed my ACT tests and my SAT tests. I mean, I crushed them. So next thing you know, I'm able to go to any school I want. I decide I'm too far from Michigan. I wanted to go to the University of Michigan, but since I'm in Texas, I'm going to go to the University of Texas so my family can see me play. Abe Lemon was a legend at the time. They fire Abe Lemon. They say he was kind of too laid back. So at the time, we had two players that were very known. One is LaSalle Thompson, went on to play 10 to 12 years in the NBA, and the other was Mike Wacker. Mike's actually went on to coach high school down here in San Antonio for numerous years. I get there with these guys, and I'm like, man, what a school. But I knew they had so many ladies walking around there that I knew at the time that wasn't the school for me because I was trying to basically rehabilitate myself and get back on the straight and narrow. So I get to Texas. I didn't think I would make it there. And then the Abe Lemon situation happened. So I had to make a quick decision, and I'll tell you quickly. I went to a game at the Hemisphere Arena here where George and the guys, the Spurs, used to play. Mm-hmm. Arkansas was playing against the University of Texas, San Antonio. Arkansas had two All-Americans, I believe, at the time, Durrell Walker and Joe Klein. And Joe Klein ended up being the first team All-American my junior year. Saw those guys play. They beat UTSA 71-42. I had friends on UTSA, so at that time, I said, man, these guys need my help. So that's the day I made up my mind. After watching that thrashing, the 71-42 thrashing, I decided I was going to go to UTSA so my mom could see me play, and also George could see me play, and also got to see George play as well at the same time. So it made sense to me, and that's how I ended up at UTSA.
I love that background there. Thanks for sharing that. You said that you go and watch George play a bit as well. What was it like to watch him when he was probably at his absolute peak? How can you describe watching your own brother dominate the league and be one of the all-time greatest players? Like, what was it like at that time to sort of see this unfolding?
Well, I know you're kind of young, Adam, so man, just picture, okay, because you study the history of the game. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, James Worthy, etc. These guys are all on one squad, kind of like what you looked at today with Golden State, with KD on the team. You had all these guys. They're the reason George never won a championship. The Spurs won like 5 or 6 division titles, all right? And I'll look at the Spurs like today, you would probably say like a Portland Trailblazer. But I took the Spurs a lot more serious. They had Artis Gilmore, George Gervin, Mike Mitchell, and those guys. But they couldn't get by the Lakers. And so when you look at the game today, man, I look at my brother's career. I feel like it's been kind of tainted somewhat. He doesn't get the just due that he deserves. And it's because they didn't win championships. I'm a big fan of Kobe Bryant, and I know you are as well. But if you look at the history of the NBA, I've watched this game since I was a kid. The two best shooting guards, and people get away from the title. It is called shooting guard.
Mm.
The two best shooting guards I've ever seen is that you got on the hat right now.
Michael Jordan,
23. And another guy is number 44 for the San Antonio Spurs. I believe my brother has the biggest arsenal of shots of any player that's ever played the game by far. Well, shooting over 50% while he did it. So if you really go back and look at the films, a lot of people won't look at them. But if you go back and look at the history, I see George and Michael Jordan by far as the two greatest shooting guards. And then I'll follow them up with Kobe Bryant and Jerry West in either order.
Well said. My NBA fandom began in 1989. I'm 44, so I'm 12 years your junior. 1985 onwards is basically where I've got a pretty good understanding of the history of the game. George was in his last seasons at that stage, I guess. So, yeah, as you said, the YouTube clips are phenomenal, and some of the highlights and moves that he's done over the years. He is somehow actually an underrated great, if that's even possible for someone who's in the Hall of Fame. At the time that George was starring with the Spurs in the NBA, seeing everything that he was achieving, how regularly were people sort of looking to compare your upside to what he was doing at the highest level?
Well, you already know, in college they were trying to give me nicknames. Ice Cube, Little Ice, you name it. I've always been the type of guy, if you go back to my high school days, they used to have me in the paper a lot there. And I wouldn't take any nicknames. I always was just Derek. You know, I try to stay humble in the game. And I always keep my feet on the ground and my head out of the clouds. And one way to do that was not to, you know, get caught up on the nicknames. And then, you know, people start calling themselves talking in third person and all that. I never wanted to do that, man. So I have to say this, Adam, because I want you to think about a part of history. You're 44, so you're born in 75. I want you to really think about my brother started his career with Dr. J and ended his career with Michael Jordan. And, you know, people talk about the NBA history. Man, you just think about the history I've been a part of. How many guys in the world could say that their brother started with great Dr. J, Julius Erving, and ended it with the great Michael Jordan? I mean, that is as rare as it gets in the basketball world, in the sports world.
It's remarkable, isn't it? So you're talking about the Virginia Squires back in the ABA and then finishing up with the Chicago Bulls in the NBA. Yeah, an incredible bookend either side there for sure. Now, speaking of your college career at University of Texas at San Antonio, your name is littered throughout the record books. I had a good scan through those over the previous weeks and months when I've been sort of researching your career. I'd love to ask you about a couple of games from your days in college. One of them is February the 13th of 1984, and your Roadrunners were 83-66 winners, and you had a 37-point game, including 22 in the second half against Joe Dumars of McNeese State. He was held to just 8 points, I read, and at the time he was the number 4 scorer in the nation. What memories come to mind when I talk about a young Joe Dumars and you competing against, obviously, guys that would go on to have very fruitful NBA careers?
It's unbelievable, Adam, because when I started at UTSA, that was only our second year of existence in basketball. And we started out right then, Division One. Man, playing against a Joe Dumars, it was fantastic. I got to see a guy. I didn't know how good he would be in the pros, but when we played against him, you know, I had read about him, kept up with him. You could see the guy's work ethic. He kind of reminded me of Kawhi. He was like the quiet assassin. Joe was very, very quiet. He led his team, but, you know, everybody's not that much of a vocal leader. Some guys lead more by example. So seeing a guy play like him, you know, I played against him. I played against Leon Wood, who's been refereeing in the NBA now for 23 years. I played against Karl Malone. So, you know, I played against Wayman Tisdale, rest in peace. So I played against some players. Alvin Robertson was just leaving at Arkansas. So Joe Klein came in. I told you, first team All-American. I played against University of Lamar. Lamar at the time was one of the top 20 teams. They had a very good team. Kendrick Perkins' dad actually was the guy that guarded me.
Oh, okay.
When we played University of Lamar. Yeah, Kenneth Perkins is the name.
Right.
Yeah, so he guarded me. So, you know, I got to be around a lot of great players, man. It was something I'll never forget. My college days might be even more impressive than my professional days because, you know, guys were still playing for free. and we still play for the love of the game. So, you know, I love the NBA, but the college days were something that was very, very special to me.
Some of those names you've mentioned there, this is your sophomore season in 1984, and Joe Klein and Leon Wood were both on the USA Olympic team in 1984 as well. So you're playing against some great players there for sure. In your junior season, you led the team to an 18-10 record, and there's one game I'd love to get your thoughts on. You had a 51-point game against Baylor, which was a school record that wouldn't be topped for 12 years. 31 points was in the first half. On the season, this is remarkable, you had double-figure points on all but one opponent for the whole season, and three times you went for 30 points or more. Do you recall that 51-point outburst, or what can you sort of remember about those high-scoring games throughout that junior campaign?
Well, my last year I averaged about 26 points a game. Playing against Baylor was special to me. It snowed that year, and it snowed in 1985. That's the first time in San Antonio in numerous, many, many years, and it only snowed that one day. So it was impressive to me because even though it snowed, people still came out to the game. I'm trying to think. I think I had kind of messed up my hair that day. I was cutting my hair. If I remember correctly, I might have been calling my mom or something. And I took the guard off my clippers. And so I kind of shaved my head a little bit unintentionally. So I called my mom and I tried to prepare her for the game and let her know I'm going to have a different look. And I was kind of embarrassed because I, you know, basically had to shave all my hair off. But I still had a game that night, so I had to come out and perform. And I guess by me being, maybe that put me in a focus state of mind because of the haircut. But yeah, I came out, played well, got off to a good start. Seemed like everything that I put up was going in. And next thing you know, halftime, they telling me I got 31 points. And I just came out and played. I wasn't the type of guy to look at the stat sheets, all that. I just went out and played the game. And at the end of the game, I end up having 51 points. And, you know, I felt pretty good because I only shot, you know, I shot 22 for 32.
You're spot on. I'm looking at the stats right now. That's the exact stats.
Yeah, well, I'll never forget. I was 22 for 32 and 7 for 8 from the line. I was kind of disappointed that I only got to the line 8 times. But overall, I thought I had a pretty good game. I had 18 rebounds, and you know, it was just a game that I remember for the rest of my life.
Yeah, you've nailed the stats perfectly. I've got the box score right in front of me, so great recall. So you left college with career averages of about 21 points and 8.5 rebounds per game, which are both still the highest in school history, if I'm not mistaken. And as a senior, as you said, you averaged 25.6 points, which is still the all-time single-season record. As we record the chat, you're the second all-time leading scorer in school history. So looking back on those three seasons that you spent at UTSA, what are you most proud of?
Well, most proud of, actually, I only played 3 years, and I left a year early. So, you know, they talk about Devin Brown beating my record. I'll let him have that, but I already know if I played my senior year, I would average about at least 30 points a game. So, you know, I'll let him go ahead and have the credit for being the leading scorer. In my mind, I'm really still the leading scorer, but, you know, the times change. We just go along with the changes. I'm happy that UTSA has recognized me. I still continue to talk to the coach today. You know, they have Steve Henson as the coach today.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, he played in the NBA as well. You know, I actually talked to him yesterday. So, you know, we'll probably be eating lunch before the week is out. So, you know, a lot of good things have come from my college career. The bottom line, the most important thing is relationships. And that's what I remember the most. That's something that you can never take away. So even after the ball stops bouncing, I will hope people realize how important these relationships are and you savor them forever.
Absolutely. Interestingly, just as a side note here, George Gervin, of course, when I say George, everyone should know I'm just talking about Iceman. He averaged 21.2 points per game in the 85 regular season. And when you were at college, you averaged 21.1 points per game throughout your career, which I just found to be an interesting similarity there. How would you describe the three seasons that the Gervins, in general, were dominating in the state of Texas?
Hey, it was funny, man. I'm telling you, I don't think it's anything better. When I played in college, George used to be on the paper every week. He'd be on one side, and I'd be on the other. And it was funny because, I mean, every week, there was not a week that didn't go by that one of us, that we weren't both in the paper. But you know what that taught me, though, Adam? If you look at George, and you know something about my brother, you kept up with him. George was a player that would help his teammates and wanted them to succeed. Say you have a player that's on the bubble. You know, this game might decide whether he stays in the NBA or not. George is the kind of guy that would help a player on either team, and I'm just putting that out there. If he could give you a basket to help you get a job, he would do that. And I don't mean that in a bad way, because I learned the same way with my teammates. I always kept a good rapport with my teammates, UTSA. I still talk to a lot of them today. And it's all about just going out helping other people. That's what the game is about. It's not just about going out the wins and losses. It goes back to the relationships again and trying to push people to be better sometimes than they even think they can be. And that's what was important to me. Everybody leads in different ways, but our thing was to be loyal to your teammates and to be good people. And to me, that's the part I learned. Other than basketball, it was about being a good person and down to earth.
That's a great attitude. Let's chat about the 1985 NBA draft. It was on June the 18th in New York. You were selected with the 20th pick of the fourth round, so 90th overall, by the Philadelphia 76ers. Where were you on draft day, and actually how did you find out that you were picked by the Sixers?
I was actually in San Antonio. I don't remember. I think it's someone from the office called me. At the time, Matt Gugis was the coach in Philly. And I believe I might have got a call from someone in the upper management. And it was kind of ironic for me. It was a great day. Because if you think about it, I brought up George earlier, who he started his career with, Dr. J. As you know, when I was drafted, and I really believe this is the reason, I was drafted by the Philadelphia 76ers. And I think a lot of it had to do with the guy they called the doctor, Julius Erving. You know, I knew Doc from the time I was 10. So he kind of knew what kind of person I was. I guess he saw me developing as a basketball player, and he had heard some things about me during my college career. So I'm kind of going to shoot a shout out to the doctor for possibly being the reason I was even drafted by Philadelphia in the first place. Thank you, Julius Erving. I love you.
I love that. That's great to hear. I read a Philadelphia Inquirer article that mentioned that you were elbowed in the face by Terry Catledge on the opening day of rookie camp, and it led to a hospital visit because it caused you some dizziness. That then earned you an invite to the 76ers fall camp because you missed the rookie camp, I assume. What are your recollections of the 3 or 4 months that you were there in Philadelphia?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you, Adam, and I haven't put this out there. I was young when I went to Philadelphia. I was really not in shape. And I'm telling you the true story. I really didn't have a concussion, and I could be honest about it this many years later.
Wow.
I was more afraid because I wasn't in condition. So Terry, he hit me with a little elbow. It wasn't really that big. And I guess just me being fatigued. You know, a boxer that's not in shape is going to get knocked out. And it's the same in basketball. I wasn't really that hurt, but I was so tired, man, that I just felt like I'll come back another day. And they did see enough of me. I actually was there more than one day. So they actually did get to see enough of me where they liked my game and they invited me back for camp. But I felt kind of bad, man, because I, you know, had people thinking that I had a concussion, and I really, really didn't. I was just a little intimidated with the surroundings at the time.
Well, it takes a lot to admit to that so many years later. You didn't need to, of course, but thank you for being so transparent. Around this time, and I'm talking about late October of 85, George was traded by the Spurs to the Chicago Bulls. And as you mentioned, he played his last season with a young Michael Jordan. Of course, it's hard to not mention that there was still talk lingering, whether it was true or not, about the alleged freeze out at the 85 All-Star game that the veteran All-Stars did to MJ. There's probably no better person to ask aside from George himself. What are your thoughts on George's final season in Chicago and that alleged freeze out of the 85 All-Star game?
Well, it was sad the way it ended because I thought George and Mike would have been a very good combination even at that time. I believe Quentin Daly might have been on that team as well. And, you know, Mike had heard about the freeze out. Supposedly it was Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas, and somehow George's name came into that conversation.
Mm.
Now, I know my brother very well. I know what kind of character he has, and, you know, we come from the same mom. We were never brought up that way to, as they say, hate on another player. And George is the type that he wanted the best that you had to offer. If you remember, George was playing against Michael Jordan at that time. So he wanted the best Mike. It would only enhance his reputation. And I'm sorry that Mike, you know, whoever gave him that story, it wasn't a true story. But Mike was young at that time, so he was easily influenced. I wish he could have got the true story. Later on, I got to play against Mike, and I told him at the time of the Nets, I'd become a starter. And before one of the jump balls, I talked to him a little bit before the ball went up, and I actually told him that I'm sorry if he felt that way, but my brother's not that kind of guy. And I had to clear that up because if you notice at the Hall of Fame, Mike still held some animosity.
Did he do it?
Yeah, he still, man. He was shooting digs at George and Dean Smith and on and on. It was kind of unfortunate. I was hoping that him and George had got to clear the air because I look back. I mean, that's something that I would have really enjoyed just to see, even though George was older at the time, he still was a smart player. And he still has something left in the tank. So, I just wish that was something that they could have fixed. And that's probably one of the most unfortunate things of my basketball career.
Well, thanks for expanding on that. George was certainly still able to score in big quantities. At one particular stage during that season in Chicago, he played. There was a game at Dallas where he had 35 points at the half, if I'm not mistaken. So he was on fire. So he could certainly still light it up, even though he was in the twilight of his NBA career. From what I've read, you also tried out with the Spurs camp in maybe fall of 1987. Do you have many memories of trying to make the Spurs roster at that time?
I wanted to try it out with the Spurs. Time, they had two guys that they had, myself and Walter Berry. And, Walter Berry was an All-American out of St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
They had a decision to make at that time. They said that they couldn't. They didn't know who could you build a team around. Was it Walter Berry or myself? And at that time, they came up, they said Walter Berry. So what ended up happening is I ended up going playing on a combined team. This was Chris Washburn's rookie year. And I ended up going playing on the combination team of Golden State and the Indiana Pacers.
Hmm.
And I go play in that, but how many guys at that time, Adam, coming from where I come from, University of Texas, San Antonio, getting their name mentioned in the same breath with Walter Berry?
Not many.
I felt pretty good about myself. The Spurs had to make a decision. They chose to go in Walter Berry's direction, and I didn't look back on it. I didn't look bad about it. I didn't feel bad about it. I think it might have been a blessing because putting me with the Spurs would have been a lot of added pressure on me and my family. And I just think things worked out for the better with me going to New Jersey as opposed to San Antonio.
Understandable. I'd just like to make mention briefly of a good friend of mine who's in the United Kingdom. His name's Kobe Sobrino. He kindly provided me a bit of background information about your journey overseas that started in 1987. So before we get to your NBA portion of your career, you headed overseas, and for the context of our listener, you arrived in Spain with some other American players as part of an all-star squad where guys had hoped to play their way into a contract in Europe. And you had a 53-point effort early on, which is a remarkable start, and you were signed quickly to a team. You played in the second-tier Spanish basketball. It was a league filled with, and Kobe has quoted me here, with unbelievably talented Americans. You had a 61-point game in your first league appearance, and your highest score was 64 points, which I think still is the second-best single-game score in the history of Spanish basketball. So thanks to Kobe for that information. You averaged 46 points per contest and played 38 games in the season. So some incredible numbers to reflect back on there. What comes to mind when you think about your time heading overseas around 1987 there, Derek?
Well, when I went, I actually went over there with Wes Matthews, used to play with the Los Angeles Lakers.
Yeah, former Bull as well.
Yeah, and Ron Brewer, who replaced George with the Spurs when he was injured.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, our University of Arkansas, Ron Brewer. So we go over to Spain. It's a touring team. We call it Gin Larios. We go over there. I think we had about 12 players, and we had some young guys at the time. I was 24, but we had some younger guys even under me. So we go over there, and we start playing against these teams from overseas. And we played Real Madrid. I'll never forget. At that time, they had to be one of the best teams in all of Europe. So we go over there. We get spanked by Real Madrid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All my guys... young, I guess they were kind of like deer in the headlights, pretty much. So after we take that whooping, I said, man, I have to get in some shape. I have to get in better shape. So, I go ahead, I pick up my work ethic in practice, go out and play real hard every day, practice hard. The next thing you know, we play against a team called Cordoba Cajasur. I go play against Cordoba. I have, I guess I scored the 53 points. The night of the game, after the game was over, Cordoba decides they wanted me for their team. This might be one of the fewest moves ever happened. I'm part of history. I was traded that night for the foreigner that was on Cordoba, Cajasur. His name was Kenneth Brooks. I believe the last name was Brooks. I know that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They trade me that night, take my contract and transfer it over to Cordoba Cajasur, and they send Mr. Brooks to my team, the Gin Larios. So I leave that night on a team bus with nothing but beds on them. At nighttime, they had the couches turned into beds. So that's the night I left. I traveled from on Spain. I leave, I think we were in Malaga, Spain. We start heading back to Cordoba. And Ron Brewer and Wes Matthews are drinking a beer as I get ready to pull off. I can hear him out the window, "Derek, this bud's for you." And that was the beginning of my Spanish career.
What a great story. I love that. What other sort of memories, either on court or off, come to mind from that time spent overseas before you headed back to the U.S.?
Man, I don't know. You know, I went to play in Israel. And when I went to Israel, that was exciting. I actually, the first year over there, I led in scoring. And that was an experience. At that time, David Blatt, former Cleveland Cavalier coach, LeBron, he was coaching over in Israel. Got to see some players that I hadn't seen in years and got to compete against some people. Actually, when I played on my first team, I had a guy they called Ice, Rodney Monroe from North Carolina State. And that's what he was known as. When he played in college, he played with a guy, Chris Corciani. They were known as Fire and Ice.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Chris Corciani was at North Carolina State.
North Carolina State.
Yeah.
So how rare is that? I go to play in Israel, and I play with a guy they call Ice. I've had a funny career, man. I've had a good career basketball-wise, but I've had some of the other things that have been a part of it that have been a great part of history.
The travel and the relationships as well, just add to that too. So it was around about June of 1988, if I've got the timeline correct. There was a newspaper in the Miami area which said that the Miami Heat were holding their first mini camp, a three-day tryout at the University of Miami. You were trying to become one of the first ever free agents to join the Heat. What do you remember of your experience of trying out for Miami there, Derek?
I think they already had these preconceived notions about me when I got there. At the time, the general manager's name was Stu Inman.
Mm-hmm.
And Stu was a big man in the NBA circles. I went there. I don't think they really gave me a chance. They had some guys they were already looking at. Actually, a friend of mine was even ranked above me. He was like 6'4 at the time. His name was Kenny Simpson. Fortunately, I got to play against Kenny over there in Spain as well. So a lot of the guys they had picked above me, I got to see again a few years later. So, you know, that was a great experience for me to see these guys get picked above me. And then I get to go compete against the one I'm in shape at a later day. And so that's something we always have to talk about for the rest of our lives.
I like that. I saw that your name was mentioned in October of 89. You were briefly linked to the LA Clippers. Did you try out with them, or were they on the verge of maybe signing you to a contract?
They were. Well, they were the first team to pay me, actually, to pay me some money. At that time, Elgin Baylor was the general manager.
How long were you involved with the Clippers?
They brought me in for camp. They paid me to come in camp. Don Casey was the coach at that time.
Don's a former guest of the show.
Yeah, Don Casey. So they brought in Don Casey. I wasn't there. The Clippers cut me at the end of camp.
All right.
It was between me and my buddy again. Another guy I got to play against overseas, Michael Young from University of Houston. And, you know, at that time, his name was bigger than mine. He'd come out of the University of Houston. He had more exposure than I did. But that was around the time that my name finally started getting out there. So I'm glad I didn't make it with the Clippers. I ended up going to Santa Barbara. And then from Santa Barbara, the rest is history.
Well, you mentioned Santa Barbara there. You're talking about the CBA team. So this is around December of 89. And something I learned whilst researching for this chat today is that you played against your brother, George, who was then a member of the Quad City Thunder. What was that like? And was there much hype in the lead up to playing against one another for possibly the first time?
Yeah, you're a funny guy, man. You do your job well, Adam. Well, you know, Santa Barbara we were the best team in the league. We were 13-0, and then our next game was against George. I had this guy used to play for the Lakers, Larry Spriggs.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to Larry recently. Larry was talking so much junk about my brother, man, how he was over the hill. At that time, George was 37. So I had all these players. I had like 6 or 7 former NBA players on my team. And all they kept talking about was, man, your brother's over the hill. He's over the hill. So me being blood, you know, I wanted to win the game. But every day I'm calling George and I'm saying, George, man, they saying you done. You over the hill. You can't play a whole game and this and that. And I guess I was putting fuel on the fire. The game finally comes. Oh, man. They beat us by 50 points. 172-122. And Larry Spriggs sat out within the first 5 minutes and never returned to the game. George goes 18 for 24 from the field, scores 45 points. I have 39, and the reporter's asking me after the game about my 39 points. And I'm like, look, sir, I respect you doing your job and doing your interviews, but are you kidding me, my man? All my 39 points did was stop us from losing by 89.
That's a fantastic story. I didn't actually know that was the outcome. That's even better. Well, Larry Spriggs probably would think twice before he next tried to talk any junk about your brother.
He wouldn't say too much today.
Thanks for sharing that sort of story. Let's get into your NBA career then. In February of 1990, you signed the first of 2 10-day contracts with the New Jersey Nets and then signed for the rest of the season to stay in New Jersey. Now, just a quick bit of background here. You were one of 7 players to score 10 or more points per game in that Nets team. And in 21 games, all off the bench, you averaged 12 points and just over 3 boards a game. The team itself went 17-65. Your leading scorer was a former guest and friend of the show, Dennis Hobson. How did it feel to finally make it to the NBA almost 5 years after first being drafted into the league?
It felt great. I was kind of, man, it's a funny situation because I was in Santa Barbara. At the time, I really wasn't ready to leave. I'll be lying if I told you otherwise. I might be the first player from in NBA history that gets called up to the NBA but didn't want to leave his surroundings.
You were just comfortable.
Well, I traveled to all the games in a limousine. Every game in Santa Barbara, I went to the in a limousine. We had people like Michael Landon from, are you familiar with Michael Landon?
Is he the actor?
And
Little House on the Prairie?
You know, he used to come to our games. We had the singer, Kenny Loggins, Mike Tyson. You know, we had people, celebrities that came to our games.
Yeah, okay.
And we were a CBA team. So when you got celebrities coming to your game, you're living 50 yards from the beach. You're traveling to all your games in limousines. I already felt like I was in the NBA. When I get the call to go to the Nets, it was something I had to do, but who wants to go from the beach to snow? So, you know, it was a good thing, but I also wouldn't mind staying in Santa Barbara a little longer.
The following season of 1991, you played 56 games and the Nets improved to 26-56 on the year. This was actually Derek Coleman's Rookie of the Year season. And according to basketballreference.com, you had a career-high 34 points. So you went off for 34 points versus Atlanta on December the 26th of 1990. But what I've read afterwards, unfortunately, not long after, you developed some back-related issues and missed some games. After returning, Chris Morris, who you'd moved ahead of in the rotation, he'd returned to start. And also Drazen Petrovic had moved into your team's rotation too. All that said, what do you, first of all, recall from that career-high game where you went off for 34, and how was that season trying to adjust with some of the setbacks of injuries and rotation?
Well, that particular game, Bill Fitch was talking trash in the locker room, and I was never a guy that was afraid to voice my opinion. He was talking about Dominique Wilkins scoring 50 points and, you know, all that foolishness. And I was saying, like, Coach, man, come on now. You give me an opportunity to start today. So if anybody gets 50, it won't be Dominique. It'll be me. I was always confident in myself. I had moved. It was hard coming from where I started and to move into the starting lineup. Chris Morris was a good friend of mine. And, you know, we practiced all, you know, every day hard against each other, but we were friends off the court. So, you know, Anthony Mason was a friend of mine, but it becomes a business. Jack Haley was a friend of mine. So, I had a lot of friends on there, but it was a business. This was my opportunity to shine. And, you know, the man above spoke clearly. It wasn't meant for me in a basketball capacity. As soon as I get my big game and we're talking about renewing my contract, I get hurt. So that told me it was more so about dealing with kids, helping kids, giving back in another way. I enjoyed my career, but my goal was to make the NBA, Adam, and to have an opportunity to be in there and do well, make my mom proud. But so I got that opportunity, and I never looked back. I would never change it. The injuries are a part of the game, but it won't take away what I did for the time that I played. So, you know, I'm just happy to be able to say I was an NBA player and to be in that fraternity forever.
Well, you're part of a very small fraternity in terms of the overall amount of people that can ever make the league. You're one of the top 300-400 players in the world for numerous years. So incredible achievement, to say the least. What did you make of Drazen Petrovic? You were crossed paths for a little while there. Sadly, of course, he tragically died in 1993, just before the NBA Finals. But how did you find interactions with him and having him as a teammate on that Nets roster?
Well, part of history again. Do you know that Drazen would have never been there if I didn't get hurt? Drazen came to the Nets after my injury. I started off playing the small forward behind Chris Morris, but eventually I started playing. They wanted to get me on the floor more, so I played the small forward and I moved to shooting guard as well. And I was backing up Reggie Theus. Mookie Blaylock was the point guard, so we had Reggie in the backcourt and myself. I get hurt. And then a week or two goes by, and Drazen's sitting on the bench just basically wasting away in Portland. And, you know, in the NBA, they don't wait. You know, you get hurt, the ship keeps on sailing. So they made a call. They end up working out a deal with Drazen while I was hurt. And when Drazen came in, you know, I could see the writing on the wall as far as playing the shooting guard. Bill Fitch made it clear that I would no longer be, you know, playing the two guard. I would be strictly coming off the bench playing backup to Chris Morris again. And the reason I wouldn't be starting anymore playing 35 minutes was because of the severity of my back at the time. So some good came out of that. I became very good friends with Drazen. I still to this day say if I had to have a contest of shooting, my three guys would be Drazen, Larry Bird, and Steph Curry. Be able to see a guy like Draz and see all the things that he brought to the table. I'm sorry that his career was cut short. And rest in peace, Draz. I think we were looking at a Hall of Fame player, closest thing to competitive-wise to Michael Jordan that we've seen, and just a great player. And I was just glad to be able to know him.
Yeah, he had an intense desire for sure. Now, in terms of the coaches, you mentioned Bill Fitch there, who some people, depending on who you ask, is a great coach and was a great influence. Others say he was really hard on them. Who were some of the coaches that stand out most to you in your career that you've actually had the chance to work with?
I'll give Bill Fitch a lot of credit because a lot of things that I didn't know about the game, he showed me. You know, he was a three-time champion. He coached Robert Parrish and Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, and all the other greats, the Dennis Johnsons. So it doesn't get much better than that. And I also played under Flip Saunders. You know, I actually won my only championship of my basketball career was playing with Flip in lacrosse. Once again, I was the guy they brought in. They couldn't beat Quad City. Year after year, Quad City was like Cleveland and Toronto. That's how we were. So they ended up trading. Flip had an idea. Let's trade Derek. Derek plays quite well against Quad City. So they bring me in from Fort Wayne. We're out of the playoffs. So they go ahead and make that move, and they bring me into lacrosse. I get there. I like it from the beginning. We have discipline. We had a superstar point guard, David Rivers, from Notre Dame, and I'm sure you're familiar with Dave.
Yeah, he played in the NBA too.
Yes, sir. And then we had Mark Davis. We had some players. We had a guy from the Milwaukee Bucks. We had Kenny Battle from University of Illinois. So I came in with some good players, and they welcomed me. Jaren Jackson, whose son is playing for Memphis right now, Jaren Jackson Jr. So I was around a great bunch of guys, and they welcomed me, and it worked for the better. They brought me in to score, and I came in and did my job. We were fortunate to win the championship. We beat Eric Musselman. I'm sure you're familiar with Eric Musselman.
Yes, I am indeed.
We were familiar to beat his team in the finals, and so I have to give Flip credit. But those will be the two coaches that stand out the most in my mind, Bill Fitch and then Flip Saunders.
Lacrosse, is that the Catbirds?
Yes.
So what season was this we're talking about?
We won in 92-93.
Okay, excellent. There you go. Backtracking a few years, after the 1991 NBA season, you returned overseas for a while to play in places such as Israel, as you mentioned earlier, and the Philippines, and then returned back to the States to play in some other leagues, including the CBA, of course, now that you've mentioned that. Did you have any other opportunities from the NBA to possibly make a roster? Were you wanting to try out one last time to see how you go, or were you content to stay doing what you were doing?
I was content because the reason I didn't try to go back to the NBA is because of my back. At that time, we didn't have the charter flights.
Mm.
So, you know, sitting in the airport for 3-4 hours, man, that was grueling. And it was painful. So I had a decision to make. And I'll tell you, like I tell anybody else, the money doesn't say NBA on it. So I had a decision, either cut my career short or go play overseas where I could play once or twice a week. And the whole idea for me doing that, it gave me time to recuperate, it gave me time to get back in the national eye, and it just gave me a chance to improve overall. So going overseas to me was one of the best things that ever happened, and I wouldn't trade those 10, 11 years in for anything.
Now, if I've got this right, in 2001, you were a member of the ABA's Detroit Dogs, and the team was coached at one stage by your brother George. How was it to have your older brother calling the shots? What was that like as far as that relationship goes as coach and player?
Well, first let me state that my nephew was on that team as well, George Gervin Jr.
Oh, wow.
So he was actually the point guard. It was different because I'm 38 now at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I was on my last leg, basically. So I just went there for the experience of getting to play for my brother and play with my nephew. But, man, you're talking about a different environment. That's the first time in my life I've been in gyms where they had guns, people carrying guns sitting in the stands.
Mm.
It was my hometown, but it was quite an adjustment from playing in high school to being in the pro. People took it very serious. The fans were really hard. I mean, they could be really, really hard on us. At the end of the day, it was a blessing because I got to play for my brother. We had our little fights, of course. I could tell you one quick story. My nephew G was playing, okay? He drives to the basket. Mm-hmm. They got the guy, the big dog, Antoine Carr, floors my nephew. You know, I kind of wanted to do something about it, so I kind of knocked Antoine's goggles kind of to the side of his face, if you want to say it. And, you know, George goes off on me. He's like, Derek, you know, what the hell are you doing? And I'm like, George, are you kidding? Did you see what he just did to G? So, you know, I go out, Antoine and I almost get in the fight. And, you know, I'm going to fight for my family. But it goes back to relationships. So after this game, of course, who you know, I had dinner with Antoine Carr, my buddy, the big dog.
You're a game man for trying to take on Antoine Carr. I'll tell you that much. He's a big boy, too.
Well, he's a big guy. But, hey, we men, man, we bleed the same. And you know, good thing is a lot of times, you know, Adam, you get into situations, but once the game is over, it's over. And, you know, you take those friendships and you carry them over. The game, once it's over, is something you don't look back on. You just move forward. And, you know, I've become friends with a lot of these guys. So, you know, a lot of good things have come from the game of basketball.
It's clear that through our conversation thus far, that the relationships you've established back then continue to this day, and that's very important, of course. Just a few more quick questions, if you don't mind, Derek. You've been really generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. In March of 2006, University of Texas at San Antonio retired your number 30 jersey. That's one of just two times, I believe, that that's ever happened. What are your memories of that fantastic achievement?
It was great because at the time we had a female athletic director, Lynn Hickey. And she just happened to be going through the history of UTSA. They hadn't retired my jersey. They actually retired Devin Brown's jersey first. But she's the athletic director, started looking through the records. And, you know, I get a call one day and she just couldn't believe when she went through the record books. Like, how could this guy's name not be in the rafters?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, when she reached out to me, I willingly accepted. I started getting a relationship back with UTSA. And you know how it is, man. You look up in that rafter every time I walk out there to the games. It's a feeling I can't describe. My name, my jersey will be up there for the rest of my life, rest of your life, hopefully. And I mean, it's something that you can never take away. So I'm proud to be called the UTSA Roadrunner.
Yeah, it's fantastic because when I do the research for these conversations, I try and do a deep dive and see what the person's achieved at all different levels. And your name was just littered throughout the books. So clearly they made the right decision by getting your name up in the rafters for sure. Basketball Digest had a regular feature which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. We might have already covered it. Is there one game from your career that you'd say would stand out more than any other?
Well, actually, I have three games, but they're all on different levels, and they're quick. My first game in high school, I come off the bench, I get 31 points. My first game in college, UTSA, we play in a tournament in Houston with the Five Slamma Jamma. I get 28 points off the bench. And then my first game in the NBA against the Philadelphia 76ers, I go 3 for 3. So I had one of the better beginnings of any level that anybody has ever had.
I'll take that every day of the week. That's great. Thank you for elaborating on that and everything we've talked about in our conversation. Another thing I love to ask former players is, do you have any particular significance to the jersey number that you wore throughout your career? I'm not sure what it was in high school, but I believe you wore number 30 at UTSA and number 24 and number 30 with the Nets. Any particular significance to those numbers, Derek?
In high school, I wore 22. I didn't want to wear George's number because I felt like at that time I was half the player he was.
I love that.
There's your 22.
I love that. That's great.
That's how I felt. Then I go to the pros. My first year, I wear 24. I couldn't get my number yet that I wanted, that I preferred, so I settled for 24. 24 was George's number at Eastern Michigan.
Uh-huh. Okay. And what about number 30?
30 is the best of all. The guy out of New York City, they call B.B. King.
Oh, Bernard.
Bernard King. I was a big, big, big Bernard King fan. I kind of tried to emulate some of his game, the way he would take guys off the dribble, shoot that pull-up jumper. I just thought he was just an offensive machine.
He was fantastic.
And see, all this history, Adam, now who's on my basketball card? If you look on one of my rookie cards, I'm driving baseline on a guy, and it's Bernard King that I'm driving on.
Fantastic. I'll have to go back and check. The only ones I have, I think they're the 89-90 NBA hoops, and I do have your card. I'll just have to look back at the picture and see if that's the one that you're referring to. I actually had the chance to meet Bernard for about 10 seconds at Madison Square Garden in 2017 on Christmas Day. He was doing a book signing for his book Game Face, and at halftime he was signing copies of the book. So I got to meet him, shake his hand, and just say how thrilled it was to meet him. So, yeah, it'd be awesome to have a chat with Bernard one day. But, yeah, what a player he was.
A great guy, I thought, Adam. I talked to him after the game. Actually, when we played them, I hugged the guy, and I had to tell him how I felt about him because, you know, I watched him come through Texas and score 50, I believe, in Dallas, and then come to San Antonio and score 50.
Oh, yeah, the back-to-back 50s, yeah.
Yes, and then for me to be able to play against him later on in my career, man, what a feeling. So just to be able to honor him and tell him about it was a big day for me.
That's fantastic. Just before we close things out, Derek, let's briefly chat about the current day. How's your involvement with the game of basketball today? And also, I'd like to really ask you about a podcast of your own that you run, which is called As Good As It Gets.
Well, I'm going to start back training probably next week, actually, back over at George Gervin. I'll be training twice a week. Other than that, I'm just basically I'm doing my podcast. That has turned into me getting ready to be to do a local show here in San Antonio.
Oh, fantastic.
I've got a partner, Ricky Hampton Sr., who's based in Detroit. He's been a godsend for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his idea for me to start doing the podcast. And once I started, I'm not looking back. I started reaching out to guys. As you know, I had George on there.
Mm-hmm.
I had Julius Irvin. I've had Oscar Robertson, Dick Vitale. I can go on and on. Dell Ellis, Alvin Robertson, Derek Coleman. Actually had Mr. Ray Scott, who was the first African-American coach of the year in NBA history.
Mm.
So I've had some great guys on there. I've even had my sister on there. She's a state representative for the city of San Antonio for the East Side. So I had her on there talking about getting out to the polls and voting, things like that. So, you know, it's a basketball show, but it goes back once again. Everything I talk about is life. So I'm going to continue to move on with this show. Hopefully my show in San Antonio will go local. I can tell you more about it later on when I'm actually on the air. And just going to keep it moving, man. I thank you for acknowledging me, Adam, because you occasionally check out my show and you write stuff to me. You and I have communicated before. I'm sorry it took so long to get on your show, but I tell you this, sometimes it's better to wait, man. Some things are better late than never. And I sincerely appreciate you, my man. And I hope you keep doing what you're doing because you're doing fantastic work.
Thank you very much, Derek. It's been great to have a chance to chat with you on the show today.
I want to tell you this, Adam, your show, my man, it's really a pleasure. I think you do really, really good stuff. You carry the torch for Michael Jordan, my man, and you do it well. And I appreciate you, and I mean that sincerely.
Thank you very much. Well, it's been great to have you on the show, Derek. Thanks for giving up, over an hour of your time. I hope we have another chance to chat in the future, and I wish you all the best with not only your podcast, but life in general, your basketball training and whatnot, and also your future or upcoming radio gig as well.
Adam, I love you, man. Thank you very much for your time, my man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Derek. Have a good night. Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. Suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. You can leave a voicemail. Simply visit inallairness.com/voice. Click start recording. Leave your message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. Press send and you're done. Worldwide, the show now has over 100 ratings on Apple Podcasts with an average of 4.5 stars, which is fantastic. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways that you can support the podcast. And if you enjoy the show, please do tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallairness.com/news. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Search for In All Airness, 3 words, on your podcast app of choice. The show is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Android, Pocket Casts, and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at InAllAirness. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/InAllAirness. Join me next time for another edition of the show.